Thanks, Jason.
I'm running late.
Log Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. It is our continuing coverage of Iditarod 2011. This is our day four coverage. On the line, we have our co-host, Michelle, calling in from Denver, and our Iditarod expert, Jason Barron, calling in from Lincoln, Montana. Guys, how are you?
Great. I'm doing great.
Jason, you called in a little late, but better late than never. I appreciate you calling in today. I know it's very quick here in the Iditarod world on Facebook and social media, so let's jump right into it. What is going on at this minute at about 6 o'clock Mountain Time, 4 o'clock Alaska time out on the trail?
Well, if you're asking me, my head is spinning. I have a lot of stuff going on my end. Part of the reason I was late calling into the show, or just like literally seconds before you went on air, was because all the different media outlets that I'm a part of are just, my blog, Facebook, and different outlets are just sizzling with the action that's coming off the trail. I mean, it really is amazing the wealth of stuff that's going on that's coming back at us. There's a couple big stories. One of them I just heard. I'd heard rumors about it. A guy, and I feel bad about this because a few of the people that I predicted would do well are really having some serious problems. Paul Gephardt, I just got some word that he has scratched the Iditarod. I heard a rumor coming that he had carried dogs into the checkpoint of Nikolai. He had a really long run, so I knew that he was having problems. But I heard that he had carried three dogs and that he was considering scratching. And indeed he has. We just got this word a couple minutes ago. So the official word is Paul Gephardt, a man who had won the Kuskokwim 300 influential race up in Alaska right before the Iditarod, and an early contender to win the Iditarod, has pulled out. So that's probably like one big story. But there's another one. But I'll give you a chance to comment on that.
Well, you know, Jason, he was a favorite to win this year's Iditarod. And talking to a lot of the guys before the ceremonial start in Anchorage on Saturday, that was, you know, kind of the hands down, if they can beat Lance, it's going to be Paul that does it. So that is a big story. I haven't seen that one yet, but that is amazing that some of the big names are having such a struggle out there this year.
Well, it is, and I was one of the people that felt like, look, Lance, having, you know, by virtue of having won four straight Iditarods and impressively having won them, not just sort of struggling to win, but winning them handily, you know, I felt like you have to put him up there as the person everybody has to beat, and if somebody's going to go through Lance, you know, I had Paul as the first guy in that lineup. Also, it bears mentioning that I have Dallas Seavey in there as another very strong contender, and I think he's in a great position. Now, here's the other part of the story is, and I'm sure you're aware of this because I kind of hear it in your voice, is that Lance is having some serious problems. And I'm probably going to draw a lot of criticism from some of his from his fan base right now, because they don't, you know, nobody wants to hear this, because Lance is such a beloved musher. He's so decorated that the thought that he might be having problems and struggling is, you know, is definitely a hot potato. However, he is. The reality is he dropped Mabel, his Golden Harness winner, lead dog of the year award winner from last year's Iditarod, and dropped her back in Roan, which is, you know, it's just one of those things. People have to understand, too. Your audience has to understand that when you hear about a driver like Paul Gephardt having dog problems and dropping out of the race, or Lance Mackey having dog problems and dropping dogs and sort of struggling, you have to compare it to, say, something maybe you're more familiar with, like, say, race car driving, where the driver pulls into the pit stop and their engine is blown on them, or they just can't seem to get the right tires, or the fuel system isn't right, or there's some sort of mechanical breakdown. That's what losing dogs out of your team for minor injuries and tiredness, that means sickness. That's, you lose these dogs out of your team and they go home and they're well cared for, but essentially you lose them out of your team and that you no longer have him pulling you down the trail. It's sort of like having a breakdown on a car. And with that said, Lance Mackey pulled and had a lackluster run into Nikolai and the same checkpoint where Paul scratched, and he immediately carried two dogs in there and had a third one and dropped all three these dogs that were having some issues. So it's leaving him with 12 dogs, and his state of mind was very bad. I mean, some people were suggesting that he's just kind of playing it sort of Machiavellian and just being kind of sneaky and sandbagging, but you know, anybody who watched the videos and read the stories about, you know, he very, very clearly saying things are not looking good for me right now. And so that is kind of a big story in itself. It tells you, it speaks volumes for what a titanic, epic driver he is, that the mere suggestion that he's having some issues that plague mere mortals, other drivers, is so unheard of. And that speaks volumes for what his accomplishments are, that we could all be so floored that he's actually having some issues.
Well, let's comment on this, and it's a 180-degree contrast, Jason. Martin Busser, who is, I believe, still in the lead at this point, he is quoted on AlaskaDailyNews.com that it's the best trail he's seen in years. So why are we having all of these struggles out on the trail this year?
Well, personally, I think, you know, and again, this is just us. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's sitting 2,500 miles away commenting on what he's seeing happening on the internet. I will tell you that Lance seemed like, I think his rest schedule, like I told everybody last night, his rest schedule was probably the best in the race. Number one, Martin Busser has always excelled at a good trail. If the trail's hard, fast, like what he called it, that is the best trail I've seen in years, he always excels. His best races have been on those trails. Now, I'm not one of the people who thinks he can only race on that kind of trail, but I know that he excels at a good trail, and he's getting that good trail. So he's in his element. And by good, we mean, you know, like a paved highway, you know, one that doesn't have a lot of holes, it isn't punchy, it isn't too hot, it isn't too cold, it's just kind of smooth sailing. Sometimes the race is belly-deep sugar snow half the race and blowing windstorms and, you know, things that are kind of cut out of a Jack London story. And that's not the case this year. They're having a kind of a miraculous run. Now, that may or may not hold up, but Martin is moving the fastest, and he's still got 16 dogs pulling out of Nikolai, so he's the quote-unquote strong team. I mean, there's plenty of race left for things to pan out or not pan out for him, but right now he's the guy that's setting the pace, and I think he will continue to do so for a while. And with that said, Lance took off. He took a nice, solid break at Nikolai, and he took off, I think, in third or fourth place out of there. And I think what you're going to see is he will run to Takotna. He'll pass up McGrath. He'll go to Takotna. He'll have his 24, and he will basically rehabilitate the 12 dogs that he currently has in front of his sled. And a day can make a huge difference with the dog team if they're feeling a little weak and a little woozy and maybe just the trail has been kind of getting to him. That his job right now is to keep Martin in sight, to keep the lead at the point of the race in sight. This is not trying to finish the race. And mind you, if he's trying to win, and he still is, his job is to kind of dual purpose, to keep Martin or whoever's leading the race in sight. In other words, don't let him get too far in front of him. Don't let him build no huge lead, but also not to push his own team over the edge. I suspect, based on how Lance is talking to the press and just what he looked like coming into the checkpoint in the video, my opinion is this. His team is very close to falling apart, and his job, and he knows it better than anybody, is to rehabilitate them very carefully, very, you know, methodically rehabilitate them. And I certainly believe he can. If anybody can, it's Lance. And so that's his thing. And with that said, I think that Lance was making some – but his rest schedule was perfect. I don't think anybody had a better rest schedule than Lance in the first part of the race, and I said that last night. But he was also putting in some uncharacteristically fast miles per hour average times. I was really kind of surprised by that he was going a lot faster than some of his competitors. I mean, you know, as much as a mile per hour faster, which is huge for a dog team. And, you know, when everything's rosy and a guy's smoking along, going fast, and everything's fine, he hasn't dropped any dogs, you go, oh, well, that's pretty cool. He's got a powerful team. But when a guy has been going really fast, and then a day or two later he's dropping dogs for minor injuries and stuff and tiredness, then you think to yourself, well, I think to myself, okay, well, he was going a little too fast. And that may or may not be the case, but I suspect it's got something to do with it.
All right. Go ahead, Michelle.
Can I ask, I read the other day, I missed the show yesterday, and I apologize, but, you know, I've got a lot of multitasking I'm trying to take care of. is Martin still listed with a broken collarbone?
That was Rick Swenson, Michelle.
If you're doing too much multitasking, messes you up.
Rick Swenson. You know, we made kind of a big deal out of this the last time. Well, was it yesterday? No, it really is. Okay. You know, it was Rick Swenson, and I will tell you that, because I was all kind of gloom and doom, like, oh, my friend, my mentor, Rick, you know, he's out of the race. And then he just gets up and saddles up his team and takes off while we were talking about on the show. So he's out there doing his thing. I don't know where he is in the standings, but the story I read is he had a big smile on his face, and he was just like, well, I'm just doing my thing. I suspect my wife had her collarbone broken in a car wreck years ago, and I suspect that what we're hearing about is a minor crack or some sort of swelling in his collarbone, because I really can't picture him traveling with, you know, his collarbone completely severed and the broken ends grinding together. But whatever the case is, he's making it down the trail, and Rick Swenson's still in the race, and I'm like really happy to hear that.
Well, he's listed on the current leaderboard at 20th right now, so he has dropped back a little bit, but he's still hanging in there, definitely higher than middle of the pack. So old Rick, he's doing well, and he is a trooper out there. If that collarbone is broken, I know I've had my collarbone broken as well. As a matter of fact, I broke it on one of my first night runs up here in Alaska this past year. I think it was just cracked, but that's a very painful. Yeah, that's a very, very painful injury, and you can't really do anything with the old broken wing when you have your collarbone broke. So Jason, I want to talk to you about something that I know a lot of listeners are probably interested in. I've got a few comments on Twitter and things about this today. It's about the competitiveness rule. And what I would like to bring up is my neighbor. I've been on the trails with him a whole bunch of times this year, Bob Story. He's the 65-year-old New Zealand musher. And he is currently in Finger Lake, and he has been there since yesterday at 1:12 p.m. And according to the leaderboard, he has not left yet. So I hope everything's well with him. But can you tell us a little bit about that new rule that's out there that you have to have a certain time in regard to the leader in order for you to continue on down the trail? Do you know anything about that, and can you comment on that?
No, not with any specificity, you know, because the rule has morphed over the years. It's a tough call. How do you, you know, number one, you have to realize that while we in the show, we've been focusing more on the competition. I think it's good that you bring the focus back to the back of the pack, is that this race is one that caters to all different types of musher. It isn't just the person who knows how to run a 90 Iditarod and, you know, some sort of epic figure should be in the movies, but it's also about the little guy, the mom and the pop, kind of, you know, the equivalent of the mom and pop driver who just wants to go there and be a part of the adventure. And the Iditarod caters to that, but with several qualifications. They don't really have to be competitive. I can't tell you what the specificity of the rule is, but I'll tell you what the intent is. The intent is that the race doesn't have the difference of, you know, 10 days or 12 days between the first driver coming into Nome and the last driver kind of straggling along at the back of the pack, that there isn't this thing where the first driver can make it to Nome in 10 days and the last driver is looking at 20 or 25. And the intention is that the drivers have to make some effort to continue down the trail. And what you have to understand is that these checkpoints are being kept open. It takes the race is responsible for you. You're out there on the trail. The race is responsible to some extent for your safety and the safety of your dogs. They have to keep a trail open for you and marked. They can't clean the trail until you've gone through. You know, this is all going through, you know, public, private BLM land. The trail has to be cleaned and swept. You know, the environmental impact has to be thought of. So they can't even start that until the last driver's through. And then also these checkpoints, I mean, some of them are just like at people's homes. They are villages that just they would really like to see the villagers, or the race only gets to go through by the grace of the community, and they just cannot have a functioning checkpoint in their village or in their house for such a period of time. So the intention of the rule is that, you know, that drivers like Bob, is it Bob?
Bob, yes, Bob Story.
He's going to have to.
He's number 15.
Yeah, I don't think he's in any danger of anything happening to him right now. But I mean, if he gets to McGrath, and he's a week behind the next team, then he is going to be. I'm sure that they will be looking at him very, very hard if they aren't already. And the intention is they cannot leave these checkpoints open for such a dramatic period of time in between one part of the last part of the race and then the last driver.
So do you know, I know I'm going to put you on the spot here, Jason, but do you have any idea how far it is from where Bob is in Finger Lake to where Martin is in Nikolai?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's it's about 80, 160, about 200 miles. They're separated by 200 miles, and on a dog team, that's a long ways.
That is. That's, 2 days at least.
Well, it's 2 days for Martin. It's going to be a week for Bob. I mean, Bob, you know, I mean, I'll tell you, if he's still sitting at Finger Lake, he's not going to make it past the next checkpoint. So I don't think it's even, I mean, you know, he's clearly, you know, there's sort of a competency issue. The Iditarod doesn't ask people to come into the race ready to rip the trail up and show everybody how to run, you know, a 1,000-mile race at a record pace. But they do expect you to come into the race to be, you know, to be competent. And if Bob's still sitting back there, he's either got some real severe health issues that are compromising his ability to continue, in which case he should not continue. Or if it's a dog related issue, then that's a competency issue. And then I would say at that point it's like, well, Bob needs to go back to the drawing board and, you know, hone his skills.
So with that, Jason, kind of the new thing these days, I don't know if it's something that's just upcropped here in the last few years, but, you know, attaching yourself to a musher that has won the race in Bob's case with Vern Halter in his kennel, as well as with Waddy McDonald and Newton Marshall last mm-hmm. year and several other mushers as we're going, they attach themselves to other mushers and get mentored for a couple of years, and then they get out and run the race for real, and they either finish or they struggle, and we don't know what's going on with Bob, so we can't say. But what about how these mentor mushers lay out the strategic plan, and they say, okay, let's just take Vern Halter and Bob's story, and Vern will tell Bob, just for argument, okay, when you get to Finger Lake, I want you to wait there 8, 10, 12 hours, whatever, and then when you get to Roan, I want you to do another 14-hour rest, or whatever the case may be. Can you comment on that at all?
It's a big subject, and it's actually kind of a touchy one with me, because I have I've never done it, and part of the reason is because I've taken lots of drivers under my wing. So let me try to back this up and put this in a politically correct kind of way. These deals that you're talking about, guys like the deal with Vern Halter and Bob, are not mentorships in the sense that the word mentor implies. They're actually a deal where the person isn't a dog musher who comes from some other discipline, you know, some other profession, and wants to be a dog musher, and not particularly a dog musher, but wants to spend a couple of years being a dog musher and wants to run the Iditarod. And they pay that driver, like a professional driver, like Vern Halter. He's a decorated Iditarod driver. I mean, he's retired now, but he's one of the all-time best. I mean, he's really a really good driver. And they go to that person with a bunch of money, and they pay to become, you know, become their apprentice, if you will. So it's not like this thing where, oh, Vern Halter or Doug Swingley or Jason Barron take some poor kid under their wing and teaches them how to run dogs. And just out of the, you know, it's a money deal. So I assume that these drivers that enter into, and look, this has been going on. I mean, it sounds kind of like a funny thing to be bringing up, like a business kind of thing. But look, this has been going on. For the person who introduced this concept to the Iditarod was the person who actually brought the Iditarod into being, which is Joe Reddington. I mean, Joe Reddington is the man who basically introduced the concept of lease drivers coming over from all different parts of the country plus Europe to lease teams from him, and it's the reason he kept such a large kennel, not only for his own Iditarod aspirations, but also so he could, you know, service all these lease contracts. Now, back in those days, we're talking about the prehistory of Iditarod mushing. Back in those days, there was, you know, the pace of the Iditarod was completely different, and the expectation on rookies and all of this stuff, everything was different back in those days. But nowadays, we have much more exacting criteria for what a rookie has to do to get into the race. And these lease drivers, essentially come to a patron like Vern Halter, for instance, and they pay a certain amount of money per year to have these services provided to them. And this driver, on paper, theoretically, the patron is supposed to educate them and provide them with a really, to the best of their ability, provide them with a really good team and a plan, which you referred to, and then it's kind of up to this other, the person who's contracting these services, like Bob, to, you know, to be, have some aptitude at it and to apply themselves and to do the best they can to follow that plan once they're on the race. I mean, I can guarantee you Vern Halter didn't lay out a plan for Bob to be still sitting in Finger Lake. I mean, I can assure you of that.
So let's just take this one step further if we can. What about the B team drivers? You know, the handlers that are working for some of these big dog yards, and you know, they've earned their stripes, so to speak. They've picked up the poop, and you know, they've done everything for years, and now they have the ability to run the B team for Didi Genro or Martin Boozer or whoever may be doing it. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that is different than the scenario you just described?
Well, it's different because it's generally speaking, the person who's not a musher. Look, you mentioned number one. I would say there are some extremely good examples of drivers who are that lease driver. Like you said, Waddy McDonald actually got to know him very. I don't know about competitively, but very well last year with 16 dogs in his team. I mean, it blew me away, and they looked beautiful coming into Nome. And he was basically leasing a team and education through, I believe. I hope I'm getting in trouble over this, but I believe it was Dean Osmar, who's a former Iditarod champion, and Newt Marshall is associated with Lance Mackey, and before that it was Hans Gott. So you know, and look at. Newton, he's up there actually being competitive right now. So, I mean, he's doing really well. What's different is that typically, though, you don't really see that. You see the old retired doctor or lawyer who just sort of wants to live, you know, sort of their Jack London fantasy, and, you know, power to him. I mean, there's nothing wrong there. But the difference between that person and then, say, the 25-year-old apprentice who's been cleaning up dog poop and just desperately wanting to be a dog musher is coming at it from a different angle, and probably is much better at it than the driver who's leasing the services typically. And they're getting, in almost all circumstances, they're getting a much better team to run. And, I mean, that's just bluntly what it is. I mean, and typically, you know, I've had a second team in the Iditarod before, and it you know, I even grew up in a culture where I would have been considered a second team driver as I was growing up in my father's kennel. And, you know, typically what's happening is these young people, men and women, are sort of like almost like working their way through mushing college, if you will, for drivers like Martin Boozer and Mitch Seavey, and they are running the best, the creme de la creme of that driver's puppy kennel, basically they're long yearlings. The dogs aren't old enough to be competitive, but they're old enough to run really a good run to Nome and get a bunch of experience. They just need a little bit more rest at checkpoints. So that's really the difference between the two types of drivers.
And many times those dogs will move up to the A team or the race team the following year after they get a little bit older than where they are now. And let's put that in just a little bit of perspective. A lot of people think puppy team. They think 6-month-old puppies toddling down the trail. What is a puppy team? How old is that?
Well, yeah, we use the phrase pretty loosely, like a dog who's turning 2 years old.
Right. So that is a puppy team in mushing, ladies and gentlemen. It's not, you know, the 8-week-old puppy that's strolling down there that just broke his harness last week. You know, he's been around the block a few times already.
Yeah, no, we're talking about dogs who are indistinguishable. Sorry, Michelle.
What was that, Michelle? Okay. All right. Jason, we have about 6 minutes left. I just wanted to make sure we got a couple of those things in for those mushers that are listening, that maybe sprint mushers or mid-distance mushers. They always have a lot of questions about leasing teams and B teams and all the strategy that goes into that. We have about 6 minutes left. What else do you want to cover today?
Well, I have to give that a little bit of thought. I want to make sure I didn't shoot my speculative kind of wad here. I mean, there really has been a lot of stuff going on. I have to confess that I've been so buried under watching the front of the race unfold, I haven't paid enough attention to the middle of the race. And not that this is the middle of the race, but it's certainly a few steps back from where Lance is at. There is a pretty good race shaping up. I perceive that where Lance and Hans and I don't know if you heard this, Robert, but maybe you have. Hans Gott is reporting, and he's pretty close to Lance right now, so he's one of the front runners. He's reporting that half his team has come down with kennel cough. Have you heard anything about that?
As a matter of fact, I have, and there was rumors floating around way before the ceremonial start that one of the top mushers, their team was infected with kennel cough, and they just kind of let it go by. And, you know, through the vet checks and everything, and there was more than one musher that was kind of grumbling about that. And that's really affecting some of the teams. And it's, you know, kennel cough isn't a big deal in itself, But if you get out there in extreme conditions, it affects a whole bunch of things, including eating and appetite and the dogs being lethargic and the whole nine yards. So with a pet dog with kennel cough, not a big deal. Just don't take them to the dog park. But with a race dog that has kennel cough, it can turn into a make-or-break situation and may even cause a musher to scratch.
Absolutely. I have scratched because of it. In fact, both years I've scratched. I'm sorry, Michelle. Go ahead.
No, I just have a question about that. Kennel cough in these conditions, in my opinion, can be extraordinarily contagious. I mean, when he beds down his dogs at the checkpoint, if the next musher comes in too close to him or beds down in his spot, he's essentially contaminating everyone else. And I have great respect for Hans Gott, and it's up to him to decide. But what about the potential harm to the other musher's dogs?
Jason?
Well, if you're, it seems like you're suggesting that maybe he should take one for the team and pull out, and I don't really agree with that. I mean, he's got way too much in here. This is going to go through the race no matter what. I mean, at this point, by the time he's exhibiting the symptoms of it, the bottom line is by the time they get to know him. I mean, you're right. This will have gone through the entire race like wildfire. I mean, I bet you 7 out of 8 teams before they get home from Nome, maybe not on the race, but by the time they get home from after the race, I bet you seven eighths of the team in this race will have been probably contract this, excepting the ones that have been properly vaccinated. But with that said, the vaccinations aren't a guarantee that you aren't going to contract this. But this is just the way it goes. He's in the race. I mean, he's got his whole year on the line. I mean, that's just, everybody knows they're taking a chance. I mean, I've scratched 2 teams because they were sick, and not necessarily because I was worried about infecting other people, but because of just the health of my team. I mean, they couldn't safely travel down the trail anymore without putting them at serious health risk. So that's why I don't have 9 Iditarod finishes under my belt. Why I say I only have 7, but I've started 9, is because I've actually pulled 2 teams for being, really ill. So I certainly have proved that I will put the needs of my team's health concerns over my competitive desires. However, we all know what risk we're taking, and the bottom line is it's like getting a bunch of kids together, at school, especially if they're all from different towns and stuff, and you put them in one area and you have all this sort of weird viruses floating around that the kids haven't seen. You know that sickness is a potential problem you're going to be facing, and that's just the breaks. I mean, I feel bad for what's happening with Lance, or what's happening with Hans, but and anybody else who gets infected. But that's the breaks.
Hold on, Michelle. With that, Jason, a lot of these top mushers use the other mid-distance races before the Iditarod to kind of get those bugs worked out of the dog systems. Of course, Lance and those guys, they don't need to run the Copper Basin and races like that anymore that the rookies are qualifying in. But
well,
they
Hans
do that.
Sure. I know I understand what you're saying is that, because I try to do that too, but a lot of people are coming from all over the world, and Hans comes from Whitehorse. So a lot of the races that he may have caught the virus from something that was percolating in Willow because he's from Whitehorse and has no exposure. I've come from Montana and gotten just wildfire kind of sickness go through my team that was probably, stemmed from Willow or the vet check before the race. And I just, some little thing, but I'm not used to it. But I want to hear what Michelle was going to follow up up with.
Go ahead, Michelle.
I was just trying to say, I wasn't suggesting that he did anything wrong here. When you have to understand, Jason, I know you don't know me, but you know Robert a little bit better. I run a training center and I do board and trains. Robert has our Siberian kennel up there that he's trying to build. So the dog yard kennels are a little bit different than when I've got Mrs. Jones' dog and Mrs. Baxter's dog and Mrs. Smith's dog coming into contact with each other, and they're quote-unquote vaccinated. That's my point, and you made it already. Vaccines sometimes don't mean anything. If you get a bad batch, if you get a bad strain of the vaccine, it can actually make your dog sick.
You are dead on, Michelle. Yes.
That's what I was trying to say is I wanted to know, if there's any way of finding out. Hans could have done the nasal spray on those dogs days before the race, and it didn't take. you know, or one of them got a bad batch and it made them sick. That's what I was trying to make the point of, is I want everybody out there to understand that vaccines aren't always a cure-all or a preventive.
Well, I think you're, you know what, that's a great point, and I'm sorry I misunderstood you. You know what, because this came up on a thread that people were talking about, Hans got having kennel sickness, and there was some vet techs got on this Facebook thread and were, you know, anybody who isn't, you know, I'm paraphrasing them, anybody who hasn't vaccinated for kennel cough, da-da-da, should be bounced out of the race. Well, I tell you what, it is a lottery. You hit the nail on the head. You can vaccinate till your heart's content for all this stuff, but it is a lottery, and I am completely unconvinced that the different nasal, you know, the different forms of vaccinating for kennel cough are really going to, heck, I've actually had teams get sick and basically have kennel cough as a result of giving them the nasal drops. So I'm very skeptical of, for just the reasons you brought up, of the whole vaccination program. But you know what, you could get me going for 2 hours on this whole subject, because,
well,
you know,
pick it up on another show, Jason. I think we're on the same page with that.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're at the end of day four of our coverage on Mushu Huskies. What are we going to talk about tomorrow, Jason? I know a lot can develop between now and 23 hours from now. What do you think? What are you forecasting here in the next next day or so?
I forecast that the drivers right now are currently running the front of the pack. Martin Boozer, Lance Mackey, Hugh Neff, Sebastian are all going to. I'm sort of using like air quotes here. I think they're kind of all beat up, and they're pushing really hard. They're kind of beat up, and they're going to go to Dakotna, and they're going to declare their 24-hour layovers. It's the mandatory 24 that everybody has to take, but they with this addendum. They can take it anywhere they like as long as it's a checkpoint. So here's where the strategy starts to come into play. There is a group of drivers, like, namely, one of the first of them leading the charge out of here is going to be Dallas Eby, who's only running about 2.5 hours behind those front runners I just mentioned. And I suspect that he's running a very powerful, very healthy team, and he's sitting where he is, kind of back from the competitive kind of front runners, but where he likes to be. And I suspect that a group of drivers led by him is going to pull into Takotna, take 5 or 6 hour breaks, and while Lance and Hugh and some of these folks stay for their full 24 hours, Dallas and some of these guys, I suspect what we're going to be talking about tomorrow is that they have or have not, we'll see, gone on to Iditarod, the halfway point, to claim the halfway prize and to declare their 24s there, which gives us a whole bunch of new material to talk about what the second half of the race is going to develop like, competitively speaking.
There you go. Jason Barron, 7-time Iditarod finisher, 9-time starting the Iditarod, and winner of several mid-distance races. So this guy knows exactly what he's talking about. And I want to make sure that we mention this every show. He does have a book available. It's called Ballad of the Northland. You can buy it right here on the Blog Talk Radio page, blogtalkradio.com/dogworks. You can buy it at Amazon. You can buy it through his website. And he has a severe presence on Facebook and everything else. So just type in Jason Barron and it will pop right up. Instead of trying to give out all the websites, it'll pop right up on Google. I did it today, and it'll take you right to where you want to go to follow this guy, because this guy knows exactly what he's talking about. He is the Iditarod insider for Mushu Huskies, and I appreciate him being on. We look forward to him being on tomorrow as well. It will be at 6 o'clock Mountain Time, 4 o'clock Alaska time, and 8 o'clock on the East Coast. And I want to encourage people that they can call in right here to our show and get right here in the queue and ask a question or two, possibly. It is 1-877-552-3889, 877-552-3889. If you have a question for me or for our Iditarod expert, Jason Barron, give us a call tomorrow, and we'll do our best to get you on air. Jason, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you tomorrow night. Michelle, thank you very much for your insight on the kennel cough. We'll talk to everybody tomorrow. This is Robert Forto. See you next time. Goodbye.